Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold, episode 75. If you are listening on the day we drop, this is February 4th for the February 5th issue of JBJS. As always, the takes are here and hot and intentionally so. We are discussing, as the best and brightest in orthopedic research in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery this month, our opinions are our own and do not reflect the opinions or policy of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, the editor-in-chief, the deputy editors, the constituent editors, or the board of trustees. I am Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, and I have with me...
Antonia Chen, deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction.
Don't mind me as I wash down my big kahuna burger with this tasty cup of coffee.
You make the world go round.
Yep, you know it. This episode of Your Case on Hold is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. We are getting into that time of year again. It is one of the best ways to familiarize yourself with what is cutting edge, important to know, and is going to give you that foundational basis to succeed in part one of the ABOS board examination. And then there's also the part two part. But also, it's a great way to get CME. It's a great way to, you know, every couple of years serve as a touchstone for people who are further along in the orthopedic discipline, too. It's in a great location in Colorado, not in Sidewinder this year. The Overlook Hotel has some maintenance difficulties. So they're not, they have an infestation of sorts. So they're not going to be able to host. But it is in a great location in all seriousness and is always well received. So sign up for it if you are interested and able. As always, like and subscribe. Please share the podcast with others who may be interested. Find us on Casto, Stitcher, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, wherever else you get your podcasts, jbjs.org. And let's move into it. The top of the pile, we have the report from the 2023 Austrian-Swiss-German Fellowship by Orth. That's kind of a cool name for somebody who's in orthopedics, right? Orth and colleagues.
Bone, that would be cool too.
And then we got development and validation of objective and subjective osteoporosis knowledge instruments among Chinese orthopedic surgeons by Mo and colleagues. What's important? Breaking bread together, finding an extracurricular pursuit by Mayer, permanently free. Sacroiliac joint function, pathology, treatment, and contribution to outcomes in spine and hip surgery by Horton, permanently free. Prevalence of complications due to transphyseal hematogenous osteomyelitis by Koshard, permanently free. Coronal plane alignment of the knee, type shifts toward constitutional varus with increasing Kellgren and Lawrence grade. A radiographic analysis of 17,365 knees by Kim and colleagues, permanently free. The impact of pelvic incidence on spinopelvic and hip alignment and mobility in asymptomatic subjects by Kim. Xylazine-associated necrotic upper extremity wounds, a single hospital system's experience with 82 patients and 125 wounds by Arango and colleagues. For the uninitiated, I do believe xylazine is, the street name is Trank, I think.
That sounds right to me.
And with that, we'll go into the headlines. So my headline is a novel preoperative scoring system to accurately predict cord-level intraoperative neuromonitoring data loss during spinal deformity surgery, a machine learning approach by Lee. So this is a study that comes to us from Columbia. They have 1,106 patients with spinal deformity and 205 perioperative variables included for a stepwise machine learning approach using random forest analysis and multivariable logistic regression. This does follow the best practices of a machine learning study. The premise is, and this is quoting the authors, although an accurate knowledge of a patient's relative risk of cord level neuromonitoring issue data loss is important for informed decision making prior to deformity correction, no preoperative risk stratification tool currently exists. They want to leverage a machine learning approach to develop the first preoperative prediction tool for cord level intraoperative neuromonitoring neurologic deficit during adult and pediatric spinal deformity surgery. So, you know, I think I may have mentioned in the past, one of my mentors used to say, do it first or do it best. And, you know, here we are with another machine learning study. The topic is interesting to have over 1,000 patients. The overall incidence of the event in question, cord level intraoperative neuromonitoring data loss, was about 5%. So it's 54 cases. I think that's the crux of the matter here. Machine learning is all well and good. Oftentimes we'll say in reviews, you know, any kind of statistical analysis approach can be deployed in any context. Oftentimes it's not about the approach that you use. Oh, we want to use propensity score matching. We want to use inverse probability weighted treatment effects. We want to use instrumental variables. We just want to do logistic regression. I mean, keep in mind, if you're just deploying logistic regression, which is one of their approaches, multivariable logistic regression was performed using beta regression coefficients to develop the score. So a regression model, conservatively, is going to require 20 events per variable. They have 54 events, and then they have 205 perioperative variables that they included. So realistically, you know, they should have 4 times as many events as they even have patients in the sample to support something of that magnitude. And people tend to look at it like it's this black box with machine learning, and you can kind of do whatever you want. But these rules are present for a reason, and I think it makes sense. You know, for every possible outcome or in every possible individual, you're going to have a mix of all of these characteristics that sort of factor into this baseline risk. And with just 54 patients, you're going to run into, it just makes sense that you're going to naturally run into some of these patients across the spectrum of possible disease state are going to be clustered in a particular area, either like severe or moderate to severe, in order to really accurately represent the condition of interest across the entire spectrum with sufficient numbers, you have to have more events than that. So it's hard for me to reconcile that the scoring utility that they develop, while interesting, is going to hold up. And this is not something that can be shown from this particular analysis. It has to be applied by others, or it has to be validated subsequently. But it's going to hold up in other settings, just because of the randomness, even within practice variation. So let's look at, they have 8 features included in the scoring system: sagittal deformity angular ratio of greater than 15, which gives you 2 points, type 3 spinal cord shape, which 2, conus level below L2, 2, cervical upper instrumented vertebrae, 2, preoperative upright largest thoracic Cobb angle of greater than 75 degrees, 2, preoperative lower extremity motor deficit, 2, preoperative upright largest kyphosis of greater than 80 degrees, 1, and total deformity angular ratio of greater than or equal to 25, 1. And higher scores were associated with increased rates of data loss. Patients with a cumulative score less than 2 had almost no data loss, less than 0.9%. Scores of 7 or above had a loss rate of 86%. The scoring system achieved an accuracy of 93%, a sensitivity of 75%, and a specificity of 94%. And AUC, that's really quite high. When you have AUCs that are that high, sometimes that's artificial because you have a limited event rate sort of clustering in a series of patients. So all the patients tend to look the same, and then it gives you this very high discriminative property. That doesn't mean that this is going to perform this way in another host of patients. Personally, I think the sensitivity of 75%, you have this scoring system ostensibly to inform the likelihood of an event that's bad. So you'd want the sensitivity to be really high. The specificity means it will be negative in the absence of the event, right? So it's good at telling you when it's not going to happen, but you don't...
That doesn't matter as much in the scoring system.
Well, it doesn't matter. Like, in a situation like this, where you have neuromonitoring data loss, which is potentially heralding a catastrophic event, you would rather be, you know, having more patients than it would actually happen. You want somebody flagged as like, this has a high likelihood of this happening, even if it doesn't happen. So that's high sensitivity. You don't really need the negative. The specificity should be high in a confirmatory test, not a screening test. And that's what this is. This is supposed to be a screening test. So, you know, even in some of the data they're presenting, I think there's cause for pause here. And I don't mean it in the 501c3 supporting the animal shelters.
I like cause for pause.
Yeah.
P-A-U-S-E, not animal.
Right. This is the first study to provide machine learning derived preoperative scoring system. I mean, all that is well and good, but again, do it first or do it best. I have a lot of questions that if this is applied in other contexts, and that's really where I think that there has been sort of a downturn in the number of scoring systems you see in the literature lately. It was kind of a la mode. Maybe 5 years ago, there were just like everybody was developing a scoring system. There's a lot of problems with developing scoring systems, most of which is that they don't actually get validated subsequently. The scoring system just gets put out there and it ends up in a publication and who knows who uses it there are no follow-on studies to subsequently validate it, to endorse it, to show how it's going to apply in bigger populations and other clinical contexts. And I really think that's necessary for something like this, because the score does seem kind of blunt in that there's really not a lot of nuance in the measures. You know, most of them all have a score of 2. It's like 2 or 0. And then there are 2 that has 1 or 0. So that again reflects that there's just a limited number of individuals with that event rate such that you can't model it that granularly. And that's why like all of these measures just get a score of 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. Everybody gets like a 2, and then there are 2 that are just 1. It's based on the beta weight, the relative, you know, risk, but you just don't have enough patients to really get a more nuanced appreciation, a more holistic appreciation. And that's why so many of these, and again, when it's just categorized like that, it's 2 or 0, 2 or 0, 2 or 0, 1 or 0. I mean, that's how scoring systems work, of course, but you would expect that there should be more variation across scores. For example, like the largest thoracic cob greater than 75 degrees is equivalent in risk to the conus below L2. I don't know.
Would more patients, validation of this, make a difference at all? Or would this study here, if you added more patients to it, would it have helped?
I think you needed more patients and more events. I mean, the total number of patients, it could be 1 million patients. If you had 54 events, it's going to be the same thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so I mean, the study itself, you probably needed more events. And the machine learning is not an anodyne. It's not a Lourdes that's going to wash away the material data element problems that are present. And a lot of people, like we've talked about this before, that it's like they want to do like a Harry Potter thing with like machine learning score. And then it creates like this magical score, and machine learning does not solve all your problems. Any kind of analysis, no matter what analytic approach you're using, what really counts is the material data itself.
That's a key factor. All right. I think so. I think it's one of those.
If it's not clear that this is, I think this should go on hold. This case is on hold.
On hold. You need a long sip of coffee for that one. I was going to say, are you going to tell me if mine's going to be on hold or not too? I've got.
Yes. So this is really interesting. Effective preoperative acupuncture and epidural steroid injection on early postoperative infection after lumbar spinal fusion. This is like a spine special issue of JBJS. This is by Sung and colleagues. There is a commentary with an infographic and permanently free, the Your Case is on Hold trifecta for this one.
So in other words, you have no excuse to not read this one and make something out of it. And so this was actually caught my eye as a non-spine surgeon, but knowing that non-operative treatments are a very important thing. Back pain, as we probably all know, especially as we get older, is experienced by greater than 70% of people at least once in their lifetime. And the patients with degenerative lumbar disease, typically you don't start with surgery. You go for non-operative treatments, including epidural steroid injections and acupuncture. And previous studies have shown that epidural steroid injections have an increased risk of infection. Not surprising. We see that in the joint. We see that in different joints and everything like that. But the real question here was, does acupuncture lead to an increased risk of infection? And up until now, it's really hard to study that question because acupuncture is typically an outpatient procedure and it's typically self-pay. And so there's no big claims database unless you do it in a prospective manner, looking at patients and collecting their information, or retrospectively, but most people don't have databases on acupuncture. Enter the Korean National Healthcare Database. Interestingly enough, their healthcare actually covers acupuncture. So there's claims information for acupuncture. Our claims information does cover epidural steroid injections, but not acupuncture. So data of insurance claims were collected from January 2010 to December 2019. And patients greater than 50 years old who underwent elective lumbar fusion surgery for degenerative diseases were included. My question is, why greater than 50? Why not greater than 40? Why not greater than 60? But why is 50 a delineator in this patient population or in this database? And patients who underwent epidural root and facet blocks in the thoracolumbar region, and those who underwent intravertebral acupuncture within 90 days prior to lumbar fusion surgery were identified. Patients who underwent acupuncture nerve blocks after spinal surgery were understandably excluded. Now, they only looked at patients who had it within 90 days before the procedure. I'm curious as to why 90 days. Most of my patients would likely have done something maybe before that, even longer than that before undergoing surgery. It might be a different patient demographic, but it'd be interesting to see even longer than 90 days prior to the lumbar fusion surgery. Patients were then divided into four groups on the basis of what preoperative procedure they had. Either they had the unexposed, which they didn't get acupuncture or a steroid injection. Those who underwent acupuncture only, those who underwent a steroid injection only, and those who underwent both procedures before undergoing spine surgery. And the outcome was postoperative infections within 90 days of the spinal surgery. And there had to be diagnostic codes relating to spinal infections to be in this instance was a database study. I think it would have been nice to see infections greater than 90 days out, up to 1 year is really the time frame for surgical site infections. The authors did want to see if the number of treatments and the timing of treatments made a difference. So they divided treatment sessions into a 0, 1, 2, 3, and greater than 3, each for acupuncture and ESI, and analyzed whether the number of sessions was associated with an increase in the risk of infection. Moreover, the duration between the last procedure and the spinal surgery were calculated and was divided into less than or equal to 2 weeks, greater than 2 to 4 weeks, and greater than 4 to 12 weeks before surgery. So because this is a nice big database study, they had over 200,000 patients who met the inclusion criteria, and majority of them were in the unexposed group. So about a little over 100,000 were in the unexposed group. But 8,700 were in the 8,726 were in the acupuncture group, 83,882 were in the steroid injection group, and 11,092 were in the combined group. The proportion of female patients in the acupuncture group was significantly higher than in other groups. And postoperative infection occurred in 8,916 patients, which is an infection rate of approximately 4.3%. That's probably pretty average for spine, pretty high for other areas. They did a pairwise comparison showing there was significant difference in the infection rate between the unexposed group and the steroid group specifically. And the rate of infection increased with the number of steroid injections received prior to surgery, but not for acupuncture or the combined group. And the incidence of postoperative infection increased as the duration between the procedure and surgery decreased in the ESI group, but not for the acupuncture group or the combined group. They did a multivariable Cox regression analysis, and they adjusted for age, sex, comorbidities, acupuncture, and steroid injections. And as age increased by 1 year, the postoperative infection rate increased by 1.004 times. Females were at a lower risk of infection compared to males. There were many different risk factors for infections after surgery, which is probably not surprising. It included peripheral vascular disease, rheumatic disease, peptic ulcer disease, mild liver disease, diabetes with chronic complications, renal disease, and any malignancies. So steroids were a risk factor for postoperative infections among the preoperative procedures, but acupuncture was not. Their take-home message for the cortisone injection specifically, that if a patient received a procedure within 2 weeks prior to surgery, if they were excluded, then getting a steroid injection was no longer a risk factor for postoperative infection. Meaning, if you waited at least 2 weeks, then your risk of infection would not be as high after corticosteroid injection. It would be nice to know about superficial infection in this realm. And it's an interesting study. It's not life-shattering, as you can imagine, but it is interesting to capture acupuncture in this patient database. And the key factor here is to basically state that acupuncture is likely safe before these lumbar fusions, although we have no idea if they're efficacious based on this study.
So large sample of patients, 207,000, almost 208,000. You know, typically it depends on the surgeon. Some will say, I don't want any ESIs 6 weeks before surgery. I think the same for joint replacement after intra-articular injection. Some will say like 3 months. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get some people who are like 6 months.
Yep.
All of it is kind of like somewhat arbitrary. Here, at least for spine, it's saying 2 weeks.
2 weeks. That's it. That's not a lot.
Yeah, that really isn't a lot. Still, I wouldn't change my practice.
That's the thing. It's one of those things where I'm surprised that there's people doing it within 2 weeks. That's probably the most surprising part of things. If we were to look at our own databases here, I don't know if we'd see the same things or not. We definitely see this in hip and knee where they do it within 2 weeks, but I would recommend waiting longer. There are insurance companies who won't allow you to do it, so they need you to wait longer. So you're right. I don't think it's going to change how we practice. I think it's just an interesting thing to really take home the acupuncture side of things.
Yeah, interesting study. And that's why it was accepted and published. All right, let's move into the Your Case is on Hold featurette. Determining if post-injury financial distress was pre-existing or injury-induced, a prospective cohort study of patients with lower extremity trauma. This is by O'Hara and colleagues. There is a visual summary and it's 30 days free. This is really a novel exploration. They describe it as a quasi-experiment. It is prospective research that was conducted at Shock Trauma in Maryland. Obviously, they have, the whole institution exists to take care of high-volume, severely injured individuals. So they performed a prospective cohort study that used 2-week recall of pre-injury financial circumstances, and it was conducted just at that one center, enrolling patients between August 2022 and May 2023. These are all patients with a surgically treated fracture of the lower extremity. And that includes anything from the calcaneus to the femoral shaft. You know, many of these injuries, you know, you can quibble about femoral shaft fracture versus calcaneus fractures, but, you know, regardless, these types of fractures are going to take people out of the working population for some period of time. Some require longer periods of recovery than others. These are also the types of injuries that you see quite frequently in motor vehicle accidents, risk-taking behaviors, falls from a height, motorcycle accidents, of course. So they ended up enrolling 200 patients, which is where they set their sample estimate. And the study sample was set trying to estimate the incidence of post-injury financial distress within a 7% margin of error, looking at a 20% change from pre-injury to post-injury, which, you know, I think makes sense in the context of you have to have a pretty big fluctuation, a big shift to create financial distress by definition. They did use mixed effects linear probability models. From a methodologic standpoint, you know, it was well done with one exception. That being, it does kind of break down into this risk factor type study where they're looking to describe new post-injury financial distress was associated with the following findings. And that's where, you know, an issue potentially can develop because they didn't build their study around a risk factor analysis. They built it around that very deliberate 20% shift in finances. Like we discussed earlier, if you're doing a risk factor study, you have to look at the variation in the population and then have essentially try and build in 20 events. So in this case, you'd have 20 episodes of financial distress for each variable that you're going to include. Otherwise, you create problems where there's going to be, within the variables you're considering, invariably restricted sample. And, you know, not necessarily for the study as a whole. If they're talking about for their primary outcome, they were powered. But if you're talking about for the secondary characteristics, then they likely are underpowered. Or they're going to develop point estimates, while significant, with lack of precision. And that's what you see. You know, they found working before the injury has an odds ratio of 6.9 with a confidence interval going from 2 to 22. So an order of magnitude, the confidence interval spans an order of magnitude. And then earning less than $70,000 per year with an odds ratio of 3.6 and a confidence interval essentially from 1 to 10, 1.2 to 10. So the upper bound is almost three times that of the point estimate. These are by definition, you know, very lacking of precision. And financial distress was associated with working before the injury is a factor that's hard for me to wrap my head around. So if you weren't working before the injury, you weren't at risk of financial distress. But if you were working before the injury, you were at risk for financial distress.
It's an endogeneity problem then.
Well, I mean, I think it's what it's reflecting is that the people who are not working had some other type of resource that was going to protect them from, right? If you're retired already and you have, or you have a trust, right? Like you're a trust fund person who doesn't have to work because you get, you know, $20,000 a month off of your passive income earnings, then you're essentially immune to financial distress. Those findings there, I think, may be restricted to this population. And that part is probably not translatable. I think what they do find that does have interest and value, including testable value, is that, you know, that 2 of 5 patients with lower extremity fractures had experienced financial distress before the injury. And then the prevalence of financial distress increased to 3 of 5 after the injury. That to me could be a testable item that could show up on.
Do you think 70,000 could set up as a testable item?
Well, I mean, anything that's in this, it shouldn't. It shouldn't. But yeah, of course it could.
It definitely could. Interesting. Yeah, I'm with you. It's hard to say, right? Like, what if you injure yourself while working? You know, that's another thing, right? So working led to you getting injured. And of course, it's going to be a financial burden because you won't be making that income that you were making before. So it's tough. I mean, it's interesting to look at, but it's tough.
I think that the finding that 2 of 5 patients with a lower extremity fracture had experienced financial distress before the injury, that also is a parochial estimate for this particular population.
Yeah.
And you're not going to, you know, if you just took a random sample of different ER departments, you're going to have some fluctuations in terms of that baseline risk. Now, maybe their measure of like the impact that it goes from 2 to 3, maybe that could be somewhat, you know, more broadly translational. I'm not sure, but the findings that, you know, essentially 40% of their population had experienced financial distress before the injury, that seems really high.
Really high. I agree.
And that might be, again, like you said, not just the nature of the work for those who are working, but also what else is going on, you know, in their lives, from risk-taking and socio-demographic characteristic, which again is only an issue when you're talking about impairing or impacting the translational capacity of this work to other settings.
Makes sense.
But, you know, interesting stuff, a novel study. I think this was funded by the NIH and the University of Maryland, Baltimore Institute for Clinical and Translational Research, and the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. So, you know, interesting and novel work and food for thought, whatever your ultimate determination, you know, may be in that regard.
Always interesting to know and keep in consideration for the patients that you're taking care of, that this is pretty impactful on them.
Yeah, that goes without saying. The humanistic side, for sure. All right, so let's get into the honorable mentions. We have vertebral body tethering in skeletally immature patients, results of a prospective U.S. FDA investigational device exemption study by Larson and colleagues. With a comment, just continuing my supposition that this really is a masquerade special interest spine issue of JBJS. As already mentioned, this was a FDA IDE, 40 prospectively enrolled patients with adolescent idiopathic scoliosis and Sanders score of less than equal to 4, Risser score less than equal to 2, underwent VBT for curves between 40 and 70 degrees. They graded this as a therapeutic level 2 study. Does seem a little bit small sample-wise, but basically they're saying in skeletally immature patients treated in the U.S. under the prospective IDE, they found 75% rate of successful outcomes at 2 years. Most correction was obtained at time of surgery, and inadequate intraoperative curve correction was associated with a higher Cobb angle on the first postoperative standing radiograph and failure by 2 years. I think, you know, a lot of those point estimates probably need some confidence intervals built around them so that you can see the precision. And when we're talking about just 40 prospectively enrolled patients, those numbers are likely to be wide. Next, we have vertebral body tethering surgery. Maybe it's the VBT special issue of JBJS. I don't know.
You get all the above.
VBT surgery study showing no increase in coronal curve magnitude after first postoperative erect radiograph in 92% of patients. The results of the study are there in the title. This is by Fan and colleagues, part of the Pediatric Spine Study Group. They considered all patients with AIS who underwent VBT over a 7-year time window and then had at least 2 years follow-up. They have 110 patients in the study. 49.1% of the 110 curves remain stable from the first postoperative to the final follow-up radiograph. Only 9 demonstrated a decrease in coronal curve magnitude, including 2 that overcorrected. Basically, from that point, they call for further research to better delineate who has curve progression, did not have progression, and are overcorrection. Finally, and rounding out, all our honorable mentions were spine studies, and I had nothing to do with it, so don't look at me. Spondylolisthesis in young patients in a large national cohort. Reoperation rate depends on surgical approach by Nielsen and colleagues. This is 30 days free, so no excuses, folks. This is a Pearl Diver study for patients under 21 who had undergone lumbar spine fusion for spondylolisthesis between 2010 and 2020. They had close to 34,000 patients. And then their main conclusion is that this is the largest reported series. We already talked about that in the New Year episode about try to be cautious with when you're talking about, you know, granular versus Pearl Diver type data, where it's just like claims-based data like that. You just got to be careful about saying stuff like that. The lowest rate of revisions within 5 years was with a combined anterior and posterior fusion approach. 5-year risk of reoperation of about 32% standalone anterior spinal fusion, according to them, appears to be unacceptably high compared with other approaches, over 4 times higher than the anterior plus posterior. And this is consistent with previous clinical series. The addition of an interbody fusion did not decrease the reoperation rate and did not appear to offer any advantages to posterior spinal fusion alone. So that is about it for us. We're about out of time. We'll try to do better next time. As always, we hope that your cases are on green and go, but no matter what, when you're in our little nexus here, the signpost up ahead says your case is on hold.
Especially those spine ones, since we have so many articles on it.